collegial or the supervisory sort, largely because it's so self-defining. I arrive at the start of a shift, or the end of a break, assess the damage wrought by the guests in my absence, count the full carts that await me, and plunge in. I could be a deaf mute as far as most of this goes, and despite all the orientation directives to smile and exude personal warmth, autism might be a definite advantage. Sometimes, if things are slow, Melissa and I will invent a task we can do together. Zoning swimsuits, for example, a nightmarish tangle of straps, and giggle, she in her Christian way, me from a more feminist perspective, about the useless little see-through wraps meant to accompany the more revealing among them. Or sometimes Ellie will give me something special to do, like putting all the basic equipment t-shirts on hangers, because things on hangers sell faster, and then arranging them neatly on racks. I like Ellie. Gray-faced and 50-ish, she must be the apotheosis of servant leadership, or, in more secular terms, the vaunted feminine style of management. She says please and thank you. She doesn't order, she asks. Not so, though, with young Howard. Assistant Manager Howard, as he is uniformly called, who rules over all of Softlines, including infants, children's, men's, accessories, and underwear. On my first day, I am called off the floor to an associates meeting, where he spends 10 minutes taking attendance, fixing each of us with his unnerving Tom Cruise-style smile, in which the brows come together as the corners of the mouth turn up, then reveals, "Where have I heard this before?" his pet peeve. Associates standing around talking to one another, which is, of course, a prime example of time theft. A few days into my career at Walmart, I return home to the Clearview to find the door to my room open and the motel owner waiting outside. There's been a problem. The sewage has backed up and is all over the floor, though fortunately my suitcase is okay. I am to move into room 127, which will be better because it has a screen. But the screen turns out to be in tatters, not even fastened at the bottom, just flapping uselessly in the breeze. I ask for a real screen, and he tells me he doesn't have any that fit. I ask for a fan, and he doesn't have any that work. I ask why. I mean, this is supposedly a working motel. And he rolls his eyes, apparently indicating my fellow residents. I could tell you stories. So I lug my possessions down to 127 and start trying to reconstruct my little domestic life. Since I don't have a kitchen, I have what I call my food bag, a supermarket bag containing my tea bags, a few pieces of fruit, various condiment packets salvaged from fast food places, and a half dozen string cheeses, which their labels say are supposed to be refrigerated, but I figure are safe in their plastic wraps. I have my laptop computer, the essential link to my normal profession, and it has become a matter of increasing concern. I figure it's probably the costliest portable item in the entire Clearview Inn, so I hesitate to leave it in my room for the 9 hours or so while I'm away at work. During the first couple of days at Walmart, the weather was cool, and I kept it in the trunk of my car. But now, with the temperature rising to the 90s at midday, I worry that it'll cook in the trunk. More to the point, at the moment, is the state of my clothing, most of which is now residing in the other brown paper bag, the one that serves as a hamper. My khakis have a day or two left in them, and 2 clean t-shirts remain until the next trip to a laundromat, but a question has been raised about the t-shirts. That afternoon, Alyssa, one of my co-orientees, now in sporting goods, had come by, ladies, to inquire about a polo shirt that had been clearanced at $7. Was there any chance it might fall still further? Of course, I had no idea. Ellie decides about clearancing. But why was Alyssa so fixated on this particular shirt? Because one of the rules is that our shirts have to have collars. So they have to be polos, not tees. Somehow I'd missed this during orientation, and now I'm wondering how long I have before my stark naked neck catches Howard's attention. At $7 an hour, a $7 shirt is just not going to make it to my shopping list. Now it's after 7, and time to resume my daily routine at the evening food-gathering phase. The town of Clearview presents only 2 low-priced options. There are no high-priced options to its kitchenless residents. A Chinese all-you-can-eat buffet or Kentucky Fried Chicken, each with its own entertainment possibilities. If I eat out at the buffet, I can watch the large Mexican families, or the even larger, in total body mass terms, families of Minnesota Anglos. If I eat KFC in my room, I can watch TV on one of the half-dozen available channels. The latter option somehow seems less lonely, especially if I can find one of my favorite programs, Titus, or Third Rock from the Sun. Eating is tricky without a table. I put the food on the chest of drawers and place a plastic supermarket bag over my lap, since spills are hard to avoid when you eat on a slant, and spills mean time and money at the laundromat. Tonight, I find the new sensation, Survivor, on CBS, where real people are struggling to light a fire on their desert island. Who are these nutcases who would volunteer for an artificially daunting situation in order to entertain millions of strangers with their half-assed efforts to survive? Then I remember where I am and why I'm here. Dinner over, I put the remains in the plastic bag that served as a tablecloth and tie it up tightly to discourage the flies that have free access to my essentially screenless abode. I do my evening things, writing in my journal and reading a novel, then turn out the lights and sit for a while by the open door for some air. 2 African-American men who live in the room next door have theirs open, too, and since it's sometimes open in the daytime as well, I've noticed that their room, like mine, has only 1 bed. This is no gay tryst, though, because they seem to take turns in the bed, one sleeping in the room and the other one napping in their van outside. I shut the door, put the window down, and undress in the dark so I can't be seen through the window. I still haven't found out much about my fellow Clearview dwellers. It's bad enough being a woman alone, especially a woman rich enough to have a bed of her own, without being nosy on top of that. As far as I can tell, the place isn't a nest of drug dealers and prostitutes. These are just working people who don't have the capital to rent a normal apartment. Even the teenagers who worried me at first seem to have mother figures attached to them, probably single mothers I hadn't seen before because they were at work. Finally, I lie down and breathe against the weight of unmoving air on my chest. I wake up a few hours later to hear a sound not generated by anyone's TV, a woman's clear alto singing 2 lines of the world's saddest song, lyrics indecipherable, to the accompaniment of trucks on the highway. Morning begins with a trip by car to the Holiday gas station's convenience store, where I buy a pop container full of ice and a packet of 2 hard-boiled eggs. The ice, a commodity unavailable at the motel, is for iced tea, which I brew by letting tea bags soak in a plastic cup of water overnight. After breakfast, I tidy up my room, making the bed, wiping the sink with a wad of toilet paper, and taking the garbage out to the dumpster. True, the owner's wife, or maybe she's the co-owner, goes around from room to room every morning with a cleaning cart. But her efforts show signs of deep depression, or possibly attention deficit disorder. Usually, she remembers to replace the thin little towels, which, even when clean, contain embedded hairs and smell like cooking grease. But there's nothing else, except maybe an abandoned rag or bottle of air freshener, to suggest that she's been through on her rounds. I picture an ad for a traditional-minded, hard-working wife. A wedding in her natal village, then, plop, she's in Clearview, Minnesota, with an Indian-American husband who may not even speak her language, thousands of miles from family, a temple, a sari shop. So, I clean up myself, then do my hair with enough bobby pins to last through the shift and head off for work. The idea is to make myself look like someone who spent the night in a regular home with kitchen and washer and dryer, not like someone who's borderline homeless. The other point of my domestic rituals and arrangements is to get through the time when I can't be at work, when it would look weird to be hanging around in the Walmart parking lot or break room. Because home life is more stressful than I have consciously acknowledged, and I would be dreading my upcoming day off if I weren't confident of spending it on the move to better quarters at the Hopkins Park Plaza. Little nervous symptoms have arisen. Sometimes I get a tummy ache after breakfast, which makes lunch dicey, and there's no way to get through the shift without at least one major refueling. More disturbing is the new habit of plucking away at my shirt or my khakis, with whichever hand can be freed up for the task. I have to stop this. My maternal grandmother, who still lives on, in a fashion, at the age of 101, was a perfect model of stoicism. But she used to pick at her face and her wrist, creating dark red circular sores, and claimed not to know she was doing it. Maybe it's an inheritable twitch, and I will soon be moving on from fabric to flesh. I arrive at work full of bounce, pausing at the fitting room to jolly up the lady on duty, usually the bossy, self-satisfied Rhoda, because the fitting room lady bears the same kind of relation to me as a cook to a server. She can screw me up if she wants, giving me carts contaminated with foreign, non-ladies' items and items not properly folded or hangered. "Here I am," I announce grandiosely, spreading out my arms. "The day can begin." For this, I get a wrinkled nose from Rhoda and a one-sided grin from Lynn, the gaunt blonde who's working bras. I search out Ellie, whom I find shooting out new labels from the pricing gun, and ask if there's anything special I need to be doing. No, just whatever needs to be done. Next, I find Melissa to get a report on the cartage so far. Today, she seems embarrassed when she sees me. "I probably shouldn't have done this, and you're going to think it's really silly, but she's brought me a sandwich for lunch." This is because I'd told her I was living in a motel, almost entirely on fast food, and she felt sorry for me. Now I'm embarrassed, and beyond that, overwhelmed to discover a covert stream of generosity running counter to the dominant corporate miserliness. Melissa probably wouldn't think of herself as poor, but I know she calculates in very small units of currency, twice reminding me, for example, that you can get 68 cents off the specials at the Radio Grill every Tuesday. So a sandwich is something to consider. I set off with my cart, muttering contentedly, "Bobby Brooks, turquoise elastic waist shorts, and faded glory, V-neck red tank top." Then, in my second week, two things change. My shift changes from 10 to 6 to 2 to 11, the so-called closing shift, although the store remains open 24/7. No one tells me this. I find it out by studying the schedules that are posted under glass on the wall outside the break room. Now I have 9 hours instead of 8, and although one of them is an unpaid dinner hour, I have a net half an hour a day more on my feet, My 2 15-minute breaks, which seemed almost superfluous on the 10-to-6 shift, now become a matter of urgent calculation. Do I take both before dinner, which is usually about 7:30, leaving an unbroken 2.5-hour stretch when I'm weariest between 8:30 and 11? Or do I try to go 2.5 hours without a break in the afternoon, followed by a nearly 3-hour marathon before I can get away for dinner? Then there's the question of how to make the best use of a 15-minute break when you have 3 or more urgent simultaneous needs. To pee, to drink something, to get outside the neon and into the natural light, and most of all, to sit down. I save about a minute by engaging in a little time theft and stopping at the restroom before I punch out for the break. And yes, we have to punch out even for breaks, so there's no padding them with a few stolen minutes. From the time clock, it's a 75-second walk to the store exit. If I stop at the Radio Grill, I could end up wasting a full 4 minutes waiting in line, not to mention the 59 cents for a small-sized iced tea. So if I treat myself to an outing in the tiny fenced-off area beside the store, the only place where employees are allowed to smoke, I get about 9 minutes off my feet. The other thing that happens is that the post-Memorial Day weekend lull definitely comes to an end. Now there are always a dozen or more shoppers rooting around in Ladies, reinforced in the evening by a wave of multi-generational gangs. Grandma, mom, a baby in the shopping cart, and a gaggle of sullen children in tow. New tasks arise, such as bunching up the carts left behind by customers and steering them to their place in the front of the store every half hour or so. Now I'm picking up not only dropped clothes, but all the odd items customers carry off from foreign departments and decide to leave with us in Ladies. Pillows, upholstery hooks, Pokemon cards, earrings, sunglasses, stuffed animals, even a package of cinnamon buns. And always there are the returns, augmented now by the huge volume of items that have been tossed on the floor or carried fecklessly to inappropriate sites. Sometimes I am lucky to achieve a steady state between replacing the returns and picking up items strewn on the racks and the floor. If I pick up misplaced items as quickly as I replace the returns, my cart never empties, and things back up dangerously at the fitting room, where Rhoda or her nighttime replacement is likely to hiss, "You've got 3 carts waiting, Barb. What's the problem?" Think Sisyphus here, or the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Still, for the first half of my shift, I am the very picture of good-natured helpfulness. Fascinated by the multi-ethnic array of our shoppers, Middle Eastern, Asian, African-American, Russian, former Yugoslavian, old-fashioned Minnesota white, and calmly accepting of the second law of thermodynamics, the one that says that entropy always wins. Amazingly, I get praised by Isabel, the thin little 70-ish lady who seems to be Ellie's adjutant. "I am doing wonderfully," she tells me, "and even better, am great to work with." I prance from rack to rack. I preen. But then somewhere around 6 or 7, when the desire to sit down becomes a serious craving, a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde transformation sets in. I cannot ignore the fact that it's the customer's sloppiness and idle whims that make me bend and crouch and run. They are the shoppers. I am the anti-shopper, whose goal is to make it look as if they'd never been in the store. At this point, aggressive hospitality gives way to aggressive hostility. Their carts bang into mine. Their children run amok. Once, I stand and watch helplessly while some rugrat pulls everything he can reach off the racks. And the thought that abortion is wasted on the unborn must show on my face, because the mother finally tells him to stop. I even start hating the customers for extraneous reasons, such as, In the case of the native Caucasians, their size. I don't mean just bellies and butts, but huge bulges in completely exotic locations, like the back of the neck and the knees. This summer, Wendy's, where I often buy lunch, has introduced the verb biggie size, as in, would you like to biggie size that combo? Meaning double the fries and pop. And something like biggie sizing seems to have happened to the female guest population. All right, everyone knows that Midwesterners, and especially those in the lower middle class, are tragically burdened by the residues of decades of potato chips and French toast sticks. And I probably shouldn't even bring this up. In my early shift Dr. Jekyll form, I feel sorry for the obese, who must choose from among our hideous woman-size offerings, our drawstring shorts and huge, horizontally striped tees, which are obviously designed to mock them. But compassion fades as the shift wears on. Those of us who work in ladies are, for obvious reasons, a pretty lean lot. Probably by Minnesota standards, candidates for emergency IV nutritional supplementation. And we live with the fear of being crushed by some wide body as she hurtles through the narrow passage from faded glory to woman size, lost in fantasies involving svelte Kathy Lee sheaths. It's the clothes I relate to, though, not the customers. And now a funny thing happens to me here on my new shift. I start thinking they're mine. Not mine to take home and wear, because I have no such designs on them. Just mine to organize and rule over. Same with ladies' wear as a whole. After 6 o'clock, when Melissa and Ellie go home, and especially after 9 o'clock, when Isabel leaves, I start to own the place. Out of the way, Sam. This is Bar Mart now. I patrol the perimeter with my cart, darting in to pick up misplaced and fallen items, making everything look spiffy from the outside. I don't fondle the clothes the way customers do. I slap them into place, commanding them to hang straight at attention or lie subdued on the shelves in perfect order. In this frame of mind, the last thing I want to see is a customer riffling around, disturbing the place. In fact, I hate the idea of things being sold, uprooted from their natural homes, whisked off to some closet that's in God knows what state of disorder. I want ladies' wear sealed off in a plastic bubble and trucked away to some place of safety, some museum of retail history. One night I come back bone-tired from my last break and am distressed to find a new person, an Asian-American or possibly Hispanic woman who can't be more than 4.5 feet tall, folding T-shirts in the white stag area. My white stag area. It's already been a vexing evening. Earlier, when I'd returned from dinner, the evening fitting room lady upbraided me for being late, which I actually wasn't, and said that if Howard knew, he probably wouldn't yell at me this time because I'm still pretty new, but if it happened again... And I'd snapped back that I could care less if Howard yelled at me, which is a difficult sentiment to fully convey without access to the forbidden four-letter words. So I'm a little wary with this intruder in white stag, and, sure enough, after our minimal introductions, she turns on me. "Did you put anything away here today?" she demands. "Well, yes, sure. In fact, I've put something away everywhere today, as I do on every other day. Because this is not in the right place. See the fabric? It's different." And she thrusts the errant item up toward my chest. True, I can see that this olive green shirt is slightly ribbed while the others are smooth. "You've got to put them in their right places," she continues. "Are you checking the UPC numbers?" "Of course I'm not checking the 10 or more digit UPC numbers, which lie just under the barcodes. Nobody does. What does she think this is, the National Academy of Sciences?" I'm not sure what kind of deference, if any, is due here. Is she my supervisor now? Or are we involved in some kind of test to see who will dominate the 9 to 11 time period? But I don't care. She's pissing me off, messing with my stuff. So I say, only without the numerals or the forbidden curse word, that 1. Plenty of other people work here during the day, not to mention all the customers coming through, so why is she blaming me? 2. It's after 10 o'clock, and I've got another cart full of returns to go, and wouldn't it make more sense if we both worked on the carts instead of zoning the goddamn t-shirts? To which she responds huffily, I don't do returns. My job is to fold. A few minutes later, I see why she doesn't do returns. She can't reach the racks. In fact, she has to use a ladder even to get to the higher shelves. And you know what I feel when I see the poor little mite pushing that ladder around? A surge of evil mirth. I peer around from where I'm working in Jordash, hoping to see her go splat. I leave that night shaken by my response to the intruder. If she's a supervisor, I could be written up for what I said, but even worse is what I thought. Am I turning mean here? And is that a normal response to the end of a 9-hour shift? There was another outbreak of mental wickedness that night. I'd gone back to the counter by the fitting room to pick up the next cart full of returns, and found the guy who answers the phone at the counter at night, a pensive young fellow in a wheelchair staring into space, looking even sadder than usual. And my uncensored thought was, at least you get to sit down. This is not me. At least not any version of me I'd like to spend much time with. Just as my tiny coworker is probably not usually a bitch. She's someone who works all night and naps during the day when her baby does, I find out later, along with the information that she's not anyone's supervisor, and is in fact subject to constant criticism by Isabel when the two overlap. What I have to face is that Barb, the name on my ID tag, is not exactly the same person as Barbara. Barb is what I was called as a child, and still am by my siblings, and I sense that at some level I'm regressing. Take away the career and the higher education, and maybe what you're left with is this original Barb, the one who might have ended up working at Walmart for real, if her father hadn't managed to climb out of the mines. So it's interesting, and more than a little disturbing, to see how Barb turned out. That she's meaner and slyer than I am, more cherishing of grudges, and not quite as smart as I'd hoped. On the day of my move to the Hopkins Park Plaza, I wake up savoring the thought of the perishables I'm going to stock my refrigerator with: mayonnaise, mustard, chicken breasts. But when I get there, Hildy is gone. And the woman in the towering black beehive who has taken her place says, I didn't understand. The room won't be available until next week, and I should call first to be sure. Had I really been so befogged by wishful thinking that I'd misunderstood what had seemed to be a fairly detailed arrangement? Bring your money down at 9 on Saturday, you can move in at 4, etc. Or had someone else just beat me to it? Never mind. I've been clear-headed enough to know all along that the Park Plaza apartment with kitchenette at $179 a week was not a long-term option on Walmart's $7 an hour. My plan had been to add a weekend job, which I've been tentatively offered at a Rainbow supermarket near the apartment where I originally stayed, at close to $8 an hour. Between the two jobs, I would be making about $320 a week after taxes, so that the $179 in rent would have amounted to about 55% of my income, which is beginning to look affordable. Actually, rents usually have to be less than 30% of one's income to be considered affordable. Housing analyst Peter Dreyer reports that 59% of poor renters, amounting to a total of 4.4 million households, spend more than 50% of their income on shelter. A 1996-97 survey of 44,461 households found that 28% of parents with incomes less than 200% of the poverty level, that is, less than about $30,000 a year, reported problems paying their rent, mortgage, or utility bills. In the Twin Cities at the time of my stay, about 46,000 working families were paying more than 50% of their income for housing, and surprisingly, 73% of these families were homeowners, hard-pressed by rising property taxes. Anyway, the Rainbow supermarket job also falls through. They decide they want me to work part-time 5 days a week, not just on weekends. Furthermore, I have no control at the moment over what my days off will be. Howard has scheduled me to have Friday off 1 week, Tuesday and Wednesday the next, and I would have to do some serious sucking up to arrive at a more stable and congenial schedule. Ergo, I either need to find a husband, like Melissa, or a second job, like some of my other co-workers. In the long run, everything will work out if I devote my mornings to job hunting while holding out for a Park Plaza opening, or, better yet, a legitimate apartment at $400 a month or $100 a week. But, to paraphrase Keynes, in the long run, we'll all be broke. At least those of us who work for low wages and live in exorbitantly overpriced motels. I call the YWCA to see whether they have any rooms, and they refer me to a place called Budget Lodging, which doesn't have any rooms either, although they do have dorm beds for $19 a night. I can have my own locker, and there's no lockout in the morning. You can hang out in your dorm bed all day if you want. Even with these enticements, I have to admit I'm relieved when the guy at Budget Lodging tells me they're located on the other side of Minneapolis, so I can rule out the dorm on account of the drive and the gas costs, at least as long as I'm working at Walmart. Maybe I should have just dumped Walmart, moved into the dorm, and relaunched my job search from there. But the truth is, I'm not ready to leave Walmart yet. It's my connection to the world, my source of identity, my place. The Budget Lodging clerk, who seems to have some familiarity with the housing nightmares of low-wage workers, suggests I keep trying motels. He's sure there must be some that cost less than $240 a week. In the meantime, the Clearview Inn wants an unconscionable $55 for any additional nights there, which means that, for a couple of nights, almost any motel would be preferable. I call Caroline to ask for her insights into the housing situation, and I should have guessed this was coming. She calls back in a few minutes to invite me to move in with her and her family. I say no. I've already had a stint of free lodging, and now I have to take my chances with the market, like anyone else. But for a moment, I get this touched-by-an-angel feeling I'd gotten from Melissa's sandwich. I am not really entirely alone. I start calling around to motels again, now ranging even farther out from the city, into the northern towns, the western towns, St. Paul. But most have no rooms at all, at any price, either now or for the coming weeks, because of the season, I'm told. Although it's hard to see why a place like, say, Clearview, Minnesota, would be a destination at any time of the year. Only the Comfort Inn has a room available, at $49.95 a night. So I make a reservation there for a couple of days. The relief I should feel about leaving the worst motel in the country is canceled by an overwhelming sense of defeat. Could I have done better? The St. Paul Pioneer Press of June 13th, which I eagerly snatch out of the box in front of Walmart, provides an overdue reality check. Apartment rents skyrocket, the front page headline declares. They've leaped 20.5% in Minneapolis in the first 3 months of 2000 alone, an unprecedented increase. according to local real estate experts. Even more pertinent to my condition, the Twin Cities region is posting one of the lowest vacancy rates in the nation, possibly the lowest. Who knew? My cursory pre-trip research had revealed nothing about a record absence of housing. In fact, I'd come across articles bemoaning the absence of a TwinCities.com industry, and these had led me to believe that the region had been spared the wild real estate inflation afflicting, for example, California's Bay Area. But, apparently, you don't need dot-com wealth to ruin an area for its low-income residents. The Pioneer Press quotes Secretary of HUD Andrew Cuomo rueing the cruel irony that prosperity is shrinking the stock of affordable housing nationwide. The stronger the economy, the stronger the upward pressure on rents. So I'm a victim not of poverty, but of prosperity. The rich and the poor, who are generally thought to live in a state of harmonious interdependence, the one providing cheap labor, the other providing low-wage jobs, can no longer coexist. I check in at the Comfort Inn in the firm expectation that this will only be for a night or two before something, somewhere, opens up to me. What I cannot know is that this is, in some sense, my moment of final defeat. Game over. End of story. At least if it's a story about attempting to match earnings to rent. In almost 3 weeks, I've spent over $500 and earned only $42 from Walmart for orientation night. There's more coming eventually. Walmart, like so many other low-wage employers, holds back your first week's pay, but eventually will be too late. I never do find an apartment or affordable motel, although I do make one last attempt, seeking help one morning at a charitable agency. I found the place by calling United Way of Minneapolis, which directed me to another agency, which in turn directed me to something called the Community Emergency Assistance Program, located a convenient 15-minute drive from Walmart. Inside the office suite housing CEAP, a disturbing scene is unfolding. Two rail-thin black men. Somalis, I guess, from their accents, and since there are a lot of them in the Twin Cities area, are saying, "Bread? Bread?" and being told, "No bread. No bread." They flutter out, and a 50-ish white woman comes in and goes through the same routine, leaving with the smile of supplication still frozen awkwardly on her face. For some reason, though, perhaps because I have an appointment and haven't worn out my welcome yet, I get taken to an inner office, where a young woman interviews me absentmindedly. "Do I have a car?" "Yes, I have a car." And a couple of minutes later, "So you don't have a car?" And so forth. When I tell her I'm working at Walmart and what I earn, she suggests I move into a shelter so I can save up enough money for a first month's rent and deposit. Then she sends me to another office, where she says I can apply for a housing subsidy and get help finding an apartment. But this other office offers only a photocopied list of affordable apartments, which is updated weekly and is already out of date. Back at the first office, my interviewer asks if I can use some emergency food aid, and I explain, once again, that I don't have a refrigerator. "She'll find something," she says, and comes back with a box containing a bar of soap, a deodorant, and a bunch of fairly useless food items from my point of view. Lots of candy and cookies, and a 1-pound can of ham, which, without a refrigerator, I would have to eat all in one sitting. The next day, I take the whole box, untouched, to another agency serving the poor, so I won't appear ungrateful, and the food won't be wasted. Middle-class people often criticize the poor for their eating habits, but this charitable agency seemed to be promoting a reliance on empty calories. The complete inventory of the box of free food I received is as follows. 21 ounces of General Mills Honey Nut Chex cereal, 24 ounces of Post Grape Nuts cereal, 20 ounces of Mississippi barbecue sauce, several small plastic bags of candy, including Tootsie Rolls, Smarties fruit snacks, sweet tarts, and 2 bars of Ghirardelli chocolate. 1 bubblegum, a 13-ounce package of iced sugar cookies, hamburger buns, 6 6-ounce Minute Maid juice coolers, 1 loaf of Vienna bread, Star Wars fruit snacks, 1 loaf of cinnamon bread, 18 ounces of peanut butter, 18 ounces of jojoba shampoo, 16 ounces of canned ham, 1 bar of Dial soap, 4 Kellogg Rice Krispies treats bars, 2 Ritz cracker packages, 1 5-ounce Swanson canned chicken breast, 2 ounces of a Kool-Aid drink-like mix, 2 Lady Speedstick deodorants. Only when I'm driving away with my sugary loot do I realize the importance of what I've learned in this encounter. At one point, toward the end of the interview, the CEAP lady had apologized for forgetting almost everything I said about myself, that I had a car, lived in a motel, etc. She was mixing me up with someone else who worked at Walmart, she explained. Someone who had been in just a few days ago. Now, of course, I've noticed that many of my coworkers are poor in all the hard-to-miss stereotypical ways. Crooked yellow teeth are one sign. Inadequate footwear is another. My feet hurt after 4 hours of work, and I wear my comfortable old Reeboks. But a lot of women run around all day in thin-soled moccasins. Hair provides another class cue. Ponytails are common, or, for that characteristic Wal-Martian beat-up and hopeless look, straight, shoulder-length hair, parted in the middle and kept out of the face by 2 bobby pins. But now I know something else. In orientation, we learned that the store's success depends entirely on us, the associates. In fact, our bright blue vests bear the statement, "At Walmart, our people make the difference." Underneath those vests, though, there are real-life charity cases, maybe even shelter dwellers. In 1988, Arkansas State Senator Jay Bradford attacked Walmart for paying its employees so little that they had to turn to the state for welfare. He was, however, unable to prove his point by getting the company to open its payroll records. So, anyway, begins my surreal existence at the Comfort Inn. I live in luxury with AC, a door that bolts, a large window protected by an intact screen, just like a tourist or a business traveler. But from there, I go out every day to a life that most business travelers would find shabby and dispiriting. Lunch at Wendy's, dinner at Sbarro, the Italian-flavored fast food place, and work at Walmart, where I would be embarrassed to be discovered in my vest should some member of the Comfort staff happen to wander in. Of course, I expect to leave any day, when the Hopkins Park Plaza opens up. For the time being, though, I revel in the splendor of my accommodations, amazed that they cost $5.05 less on a daily basis than what I was paying for that rat hole in Clearview. I stop worrying about my computer being stolen or cooked. I sleep through the night. The sick little plucking habit loses its grip. I feel like the man in the commercials for the Holiday Inn Express, who's so refreshed by his overnight stay that he can perform surgery the next day or instruct people in how to use a parachute. At Walmart, I get better at what I do, much better than I could ever have imagined at the beginning. The breakthrough comes on a Saturday, one of your heavier shopping days. There are 2 carts waiting for me when I arrive at 2, and tossed items inches deep on major patches of the floor. The place hasn't been shopped. It's been looted. In this situation, all I can do is everything at once. Stoop, reach, bend, lift, run from rack to rack with my cart. And then it happens. A magical flow state in which the clothes start putting themselves away. Oh, I play a part in this, but not in any conscious way. Instead of thinking white stag navy twill skort and doggedly searching out similar skorts, all I have to do is form an image of the item in my mind, transpose this image onto the visual field, and move to wherever the image finds its match in the outer world. I don't know how this works. Maybe my mind just gets so busy processing the incoming visual data that it has to bypass the left brain's verbal centers with their cumbersome instructions. Proceed to white stag area in the northwest corner of ladies. Try bottom racks near khaki shorts. Or maybe the trick lies in understanding that each item wants to be reunited with its sibs and its clan members, and that within each clan, the item wants to occupy its proper place in the color size hierarchy. Once I let the clothes take charge, once I understand that I am only the means of their reunification, they just fly out of the cart to their natural homes. On the same day, perhaps because the new speediness frees me to think more clearly, I make my peace with the customers and discover the purpose of life, or at least of my life at Walmart. Management may think that the purpose is to sell things, but this is an overly reductionist, narrowly capitalist view. As a matter of fact, I never see anything sold, since sales take place out of my sight, at the cash registers at the front of the store. All I see is customers unfolding carefully folded T-shirts, taking dresses and pants off their hangers, holding them up for a moment's idle inspection, then dropping them somewhere for us associates to pick up. For me, the way out of resentment begins with a clue provided by a poster near the break room in the back of the store where only associates go. "Your mother doesn't work here," it says. "Please pick up after yourself." I've passed it many times, thinking, that's all I do, pick up after people. Then it hits me. Most of the people I pick up after are mothers themselves, meaning that what I do at work is what they do at home, pick up the toys and the clothes and the spills. So the great thing about shopping, for most of these women, is that here they get to behave like brats, ignoring the bawling babies in their carts, tossing things around for someone else to pick up. And it wouldn't be any fun, would it? Unless the clothes were all reasonably orderly to begin with, which is where I come in, constantly recreating orderliness for the customers to maliciously destroy. It's appalling, but it's in their nature. Only pristine and virginal displays truly excite them. I test this theory out on Isabel, that our job is to constantly recreate the stage setting in which women can act out, that without us, rates of child abuse would suddenly soar, that we function, in a way, as therapists, and should probably be paid accordingly, at $50 to $100 an hour. "You just go on thinking that," she says, shaking her head. But she smiles her canny little smile, in a way that makes me think it's not a bad notion. With competence comes a new impatience. Why does anybody put up with the wages we're paid? True, most of my fellow workers are better cushioned than I am. They live with spouses or grown children, or they have other jobs in addition to this one. I sit with Lynn in the break room one night and find out this is only a part-time job for her, 6 hours a day, with the other 8 hours spent at a factory for $9 an hour. Doesn't she get awfully tired? Nah, it's what she's always done. The cook at the radio grill has two other jobs. You might expect a bit of grumbling, some signs here and there of unrest, graffiti on the hortatory posters in the break room, muffled guffaws during our associate meetings. But I can detect none of that. Maybe this is what you get when you weed out all the rebels with drug tests and personality surveys. A uniformly servile and denatured workforce, content to dream of the distant day when they'll be vested in the company's profit-sharing plan. They even join in the Walmart cheer when required to do so at meetings, I'm told by the evening fitting room lady, though I am fortunate enough never to witness this final abasement. According to Walmart expert Bob Ortega, Sam Walton got the idea for the cheer on a 1975 trip to Japan, where he was deeply impressed by factory workers doing group calisthenics and company cheers. Ortega describes Walton conducting a cheer. "Give me a W," he'd shout. "W," the workers would shout back, and on through the Walmart name. At the hyphen, Walton would shout, "Give me a squiggly," and squat and twist his hips at the same time. The workers would squiggle right back. But if it's hard to think out of the box, it may be almost impossible to think out of the big box. Walmart, when you're in it, is total, a closed system, a world unto itself. I get a chill when I'm watching TV in the break room one afternoon and see a commercial for Walmart. When a Walmart shows up within a television within a Walmart, you have to question the existence of an outer world. Sure, you can drive for 5 minutes and get somewhere else. To Kmart, that is, or Home Depot, or Target, or Burger King, or Wendy's, or KFC. Wherever you look, there is no alternative to the mega-scale corporate order from which every form of local creativity and initiative has been abolished by distant home offices. Even the woods and the meadows have been stripped of disorderly life forms and forced into a uniform made of concrete. What you see, highways, parking lots, stores, is all there is, or all that's left to us here in the reign of globalized, totalized, paved over, corporatized everything. I like to read the labels to find out where the clothing we sell is made. Indonesia, Mexico, Turkey, the Philippines, South Korea, Sri Lanka, Brazil. But the labels serve only to remind me that none of these places is exotic anymore. That they've all been eaten by the great blind profit-making global machine. The only thing to do is ask, why do we work here? Why do you stay? So when Isabel praises my work a second time, I take the opportunity to say, I really appreciate her encouragement, but I can't afford to live on $7 an hour, and how does she do it? The answer is that she lives with her grown daughter, who also works, plus the fact that she's worked here 2 years, during which her pay has shot up to $7.75 an hour. She counsels patience. It could happen to me. Melissa, who has the advantage of a working husband, says, "Well, it's a job." Yes, she made twice as much when she was a waitress, but that place closed down, and at her age, she's never going to be hired at a high-tip place. I recognize the inertia, the unwillingness to start up with the apps and the interviews and the drug tests again. She thinks she should give it another year. A year? I tell her I'm wondering whether I should give it another week. A few days later, something happens to make kindly, sweet-natured Melissa mad. She gets banished to Bras, which is terra incognita for us. Huge banks of shelves bearing barely distinguishable biconed objects for a 3-hour stretch. The Walmart Associate Handbook says, during your career with Walmart, you may be cross-trained in other departments in your facility. This will challenge you in new areas and help you be a well-rounded associate. I know how Melissa feels, because I was once sent over to work for a couple of hours in menswear, where I wandered uselessly through the strange thickets of racks, numbed by the sameness of colors and styles. It's the difference between working and pretending to work. You push your cart a few feet, pause significantly with item in hand, frown at the ambient racks, then push on and repeat the process. "I just don't like wasting their money," Melissa says when she's allowed back. "I mean, they're paying me, and I just wasn't accomplishing anything over there. To me, this anger seems badly misaimed. What does she think? That the Walton family is living in some hidden room in the back of the store, in the utmost frugality, and likely to be ruined by $21 worth of wasted labor? I'm starting in on that theme when she suddenly dives behind the rack that separates the place where we're standing, in the Jordache No Boundaries section, from the Faded Glory region. Worried that I may have offended her somehow, I follow right behind. "Howard," she whispers. "Didn't you see him come by? We're not allowed to talk to each other, you know." The point is, our time is so cheap. They don't care if we waste it, I continue, aware, even as I speak, that this isn't true. Otherwise, why would they constantly be monitoring us for time theft? But I sputter on. That's what's so insulting. Of course, in this outburst of militance, I am completely not noticing the context. Two women of mature years, two very hard-working women, as it happens, dodging behind a clothing rack to avoid a 26-year-old management twerp. That's not even worth commenting on. Alyssa is another target for my crusade. When she returns to check yet again on that $7 polo, she finds a stain on it. What could she get off for that? I think 10%, and if you add in the 10% employee discount, we'd be down to $5.60. I'm trying to negotiate a 20% price reduction with the fitting room lady when, rotten luck, Howard shows up and announces that there are no reductions and no employee discounts on clearanced items. Those are the rules. Alyssa looks crushed, and I tell her when Howard's out of sight that there's something wrong when you're not paid enough to buy a Walmart shirt, a clearanced Walmart shirt with a stain on it. "I hear you," she says, and admits Walmart isn't working for her either, if the goal is to make a living. Then I get a little reckless. When an associate meeting is announced over the loudspeaker that afternoon, I decide to go, although most of my coworkers stay put. I don't understand the purpose of these meetings, which occur every 3 days or so, and largely consist of attendance-taking, unless it's Howard's way of showing us that there's only one of him compared to so many of us. I'm just happy to have a few minutes to sit down, or in this case, perch on some fertilizer bags, since we're meeting in lawn and garden today, and chat with whoever shows up. Today, a gal from the optical department. She's better coiffed and made up than most of us female associates, forced to take the job because of a recent divorce, she tells me, and sorry now that she's found out how crummy the health insurance is. There follows a long story about pre-existing conditions and deductibles and her Cobra running out. I listen vacantly, because like most of the other people in my orientation group, I hadn't opted for the health insurance. The employee contributions seemed too high. "You know what we need here?" I finally respond. "We need a union." There it is. The word is out. Maybe if I hadn't been feeling so footsore, I wouldn't have said it. And I probably wouldn't have said it either if we were allowed to say hell and damn now and then. Or better yet, shit. But no one has outright banned the word union. And right now, it's the most potent couple of syllables at hand. "We need something," she responds. After that, there's nothing to stop me. I'm on a mission now. Raise the questions, plant the seeds. Breaks finally have a purpose beyond getting off my feet. There are hundreds of workers here. I never do find out how many. And sooner or later, I'll meet them all. I reject the break room for this purpose because the TV inhibits conversation. And, for all I know, that's what it's supposed to do. Better to go outdoors to the fenced-in smoking area in front of the store. Smokers in smoke-free America are more likely to be rebels. At least that was true at the maids, where the non-smokers waited silently in the office for work to begin, while the smokers out on the sidewalk would be having a raucous old time. Besides, you can always start the ball rolling by asking for a light, which I have to do anyway when the wind is up. The next question is, what department are you in? Followed by, how long have you worked here? From which it's an obvious segue to the business at hand. Almost everyone is eager to talk, and I soon become a walking repository of complaints. No one gets paid overtime at Walmart, I'm told, though there's often pressure to work it. Walmart employees have sued the retail chain for unpaid overtime in 4 states, West Virginia, New Mexico, Oregon, and Colorado. The plaintiffs allege that they were pressured to work overtime, and that the company then erased the overtime hours from their time records. 2 of the West Virginia plaintiffs, who had been promoted to management positions before leaving Walmart, said they had participated in altering time records to conceal overtime work. Instead of paying time and a half for overtime work, the company would reward workers with desired schedule changes, promotions, and other benefits, while workers who refused the unpaid overtime were threatened with write-ups, demotions, reduced work schedules, or docked pay. In New Mexico, a suit by 110 Walmart employees was settled in 1998 when the company agreed to pay for the overtime. In an email to me, Walmart spokesman William Wirtz stated that it is Walmart's policy to compensate its employees fairly for their work and to comply fully with all federal and state wage and hour requirements. Many feel the health insurance isn't worth paying for. There's a lot of frustration over schedules, especially in the case of the evangelical lady who can never get Sunday morning off, no matter how much she pleads. And always there are the gripes about managers. The one who's known for sending new hires home in tears. The one who takes a ruler and knocks everything off what he regards a messy shelf, so you have to pick it up off the floor and start over. Sometimes, I discover, my favorite subject, which is the abysmal rate of pay, seems to be a painful one. Stan, for example, a 20-something fellow with wildly misaligned teeth, is so eager to talk that he fairly pounces on the seat next to mine on a bench in the smoking area. But when the subject arrives at wages, his face falls. The idea, see, was that he would go to school. He names a 2-year technical school, while he worked. But the work cut into studying too much, so he had to drop out, and now he stares at the butt-strewed ground, perhaps seeing an eternity in appliances unfold before him. I suggest that what we need is a union. But from the look on his face, I might as well have said gumballs or Prozac. Yeah. Maybe he'll go over and apply at Media One, where a friend works and the wages are higher. Try school again. At the other extreme, there are people like Marlene. I'm sitting out there talking to a doll-like blonde whom I had taken for a high school student, but who, it turns out, has been working full-time since November and is fretting over whether she can afford to buy a car. Marlene comes out for her break, lights a cigarette, and emphatically seconds my opinion of Walmart wages. They talk about having spirit, she says, referring to management. But they don't give us any reason to have any spirit. In her view, Walmart would rather just keep hiring new people than treating the ones it has decently. You can see for yourself there's a dozen new people coming in for orientation every day, which is true. Walmart's appetite for human flesh is insatiable. We've even been urged to recruit any Kmart employees we may happen to know. They don't care that they've trained you or anything, Marlene goes on. They can always get someone else if you complain. Emboldened by her vehemence, I risk the red-hot word again. I know this goes against the whole Walmart philosophy, but we could use a union here. She grins. So I push on. It's not just about money. It's about dignity. She nods fiercely, lighting a second cigarette from her first. Put that woman on the organizing committee at once, I direct my imaginary co-conspirators as I leave. All right. I'm not a union organizer any more than I'm Walmart management material, as Isabel has hinted. In fact, I don't share the belief, held by many union staffers, that unionization would be a panacea. Sure, almost any old union would boost wages and straighten out some backbones here. But I know that even the most energetic and democratic unions bear careful watching by their members. The truth, which I can't avoid acknowledging when I'm in those vast, desert-like stretches between afternoon breaks, is that I'm just amusing myself. And in what seems like a pretty harmless way. Someone has to puncture the prevailing fiction that we're a family here. We associates and our servant leaders held together solely by our commitment to the guests. After all, you'd need a lot stronger word than dysfunctional to describe a family where a few people get to eat at the table, while the rest, the associates and all the dark-skinned seamstresses and factory workers worldwide who make the things we sell, lick up the drippings from the floor. Psychotic would be closer to the mark. In 1996, the National Labor Committee Education Fund in support of worker and human rights in Central America revealed that some Kathy Lee clothes were being sewn by children as young as 12 in a sweatshop in Honduras. TV personality Kathy Lee Gifford, the owner of the Kathy Lee line, tearfully denied the charges on the air, but later promised to give up her dependence on sweatshops. Someone has to flush out the mysterious we lurking in the our, in the our people make the difference statement we wear on our backs. It might as well be me, because I have nothing to lose. Less than nothing, in fact. For each day that I fail to find cheaper quarters, which is every day now, I'm spending $49.95 for the privilege of putting clothes away at Walmart. At this rate, I'll have burned through the rest of the $1,200 I've allotted for my life in Minneapolis in less than a week. I could use some amusement. I've been discovering a great truth about low-wage work, and probably a lot of medium-wage work, too, that nothing happens. Or rather, the same thing always happens, which amounts, day after day, to nothing. This law doesn't apply so strictly to the service jobs I've held so far. In waitressing, you always have new customers to study. Even house cleaning offers the day's parade of houses to explore. But here, well, you know what I do and how it gets undone, and how I just start all over and do it again. How did I think I was going to survive in a factory where each minute is identical to the next one, and not just each day? There will be no crises here, except perhaps in the pre-Christmas rush. There will be no Code M, meaning hostage situation, and probably no Code F or T, meaning fire or tornado. I'm guessing on these letters, which I didn't write down during my note-taking at orientation, and which may be a company secret anyway. No opportunities for courage or extraordinary achievement or sudden evacuations of the store. Those breaking news moments when a disgruntled former employee shoots up the place or a bunch of people get crushed in an avalanche of piled-up stock are one in a million events. What my life holds is carts. Full ones, then empty ones, then full ones again. You could get old pretty fast here. In fact, time does funny things when there are no little surprises to mark it off into memorable chunks, and I sense that I'm already several years older than I was when I started. In the one full-length mirror in ladies' wear, a medium-tall figure is hunched over a cart, her face pinched in absurd concentration. Surely not me. How long before I'm as gray as Ellie, as cranky as Rhoda, as shriveled as Isabel. When even a high-sodium fast-food diet can't keep me from needing to pee every hour, and my feet are putting some podiatrist kid through college? Yes, I know that any day now I'm going to return to the variety and drama of my real Barbara Ehrenreich life. But this fact sustains me only in the way that, say, the prospect of heaven cheers a terminally ill person. It's nice to know, but it isn't much help from moment to moment. What you don't necessarily realize when you start selling your time by the hour